What's up, everybody? Welcome to SWAT MMA. This is episode number 140. I am Jared here with Paul.
What up?
Coming to you from Las Vegas, Nevada. Today, we're going to be smoking and talking all about UFC Fight Night Ortega versus Rodriguez. Does the winner of this fight get the next title shot in the featherweight division over Josh Emmett? Plus, this card sees the debut of former UFC bantamweight champion Miesha Tate in the flyweight division, facing off against third-ranked Lauren Murphy. Does a win over Murphy earn her a title shot against champion Valentina Shevchenko? Plus, we're going to be discussing some surprising numbers in the PFL salaries released from their latest event. This and more on today's SWAT MMA. But before we get into the combat sports, you know what time it is. Grab your weed, fire it up, and let's get into the weed of the week. Ooh, you got the packs fired up. What is in here at the moment?
Gunpowder haze left over from last week.
This is a what?
Don't remember.
Is it a rosin? Or
oh,
a...
yeah, it's rosin, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's pretty smooth. I don't really remember it from last week. Must have been pretty stoned. We got a brand new flower today as well. We've got some fresh squeezed OG. This is a sativa dominant hybrid. And it's got some interesting genetics as well as flavors. Let's talk about the flavors here for a minute before we dive into the genetics. Really smooth on the intake on this. And I got to say, on the exhale, it's got a really nice, pleasant orange flavor, hence the name Fresh Squeezed,
yeah.
Reminiscent of some fresh squeezed orange juice. This is a hybrid of Face Off OG and Ohio Lemon G. First, we'll talk about the Face Off. Face Off OG is simply a very, very good OG Kush phenotype. Ohio Lemon G, however, has a little bit of mystery behind it. It is a cross of G13 and an unknown, what is believed to be an unknown sativa or skunk. Some people think it's lemon skunk, which is where we get the lemon flavor in this weed, which kind of translates with the breeding. It's a little bit more of an orange flavor. But the G13, Paul, have you heard of this weed before?
G13, no.
G13 is a little bit interesting because it's got a big urban legend kind of based around it. The urban legend says, and it's probably not true, but it's fun. And let me hit this PAX here. This looks pretty stony. Do you remember what the THC content on this rosin was?
I believe it was like 83.
All right, so the legend of G13 is back in the 1960s at some time. The CIA and the FBI got together with some other government agencies and asked all the top cannabis breeders in the United States to come together at the University of Mississippi for a super secret project where they created some powerful hybrid strains of cannabis in the perfect lab conditions for government testing. And G13 was one of the most potent strains created that got out of this experiment due to a lab technician or worker taking a single clipping off of a plant and then creating a clone from there. And here, all these years later, we have the ultra-powerful G13. Probably a bunch of bullshit, but it's a fun urban legend on the weed.
It's not that far-fetched.
Right, it's not completely crazy. You could see where it could have a root of truth in there somewhere, right? So there's a little bit of fun information for everybody on that. And let's go ahead. Oh, shit. And there we go. We got to set this PAX on something level till it cools down a little bit. Also got a pen today with some LAOG. It's a vape cartridge. This is nice. This is from Tahoe here in Vegas. It has 98% THC on this bad boy.
There you go.
So we'll be hitting that throughout the
now
show.
Now we're talking.
Right. And I'm going to spark up this bowl of freshly squeezed. And let's dive into some combat sports for everybody. But you know something I'd really like to talk about? Because it's a brief conversation. It's the PFL paydays that were released, or their salaries, whatever you want to say, on their latest event that featured Anthony Pettis and Kyla Harrison on top of the card. And after that, we'll dive into this UFC fight night. Because, you know, Paul, there's a lot of talk in the MMA community about fighter pay.
Yeah.
It's a hot topic of conversation. The UFC is, of course, the number one promotion. You would think that they pay the highest. That would make sense, right? They're the epitome of the league or the sport. And it's pretty well accepted in released court documents here due to the civil litigation that's going on against them, the antitrust lawsuit. We know that they pay roughly between 15 and 18% of their revenue out in fighter salaries. And we know, due to collective bargaining agreements and unionization of the other major sports, that those are all around 50-50 splits for basketball, football, hockey, mixed martial arts. These guys are severely underpaid in comparison to even to boxing. The top boxers make way more money. You know, George Kambosos is an Australian boxer, roughly the same size as Alexander Volkanovski, right? He just had his very first title defense against Devin Haney in his home country, where he earned $10 million for that, okay?
And he lost.
And he lost. And in his home country, by the way, that is estimated to have sold about 50,000 pay-per-views, okay? Now, you've got Alexander Volkanovski, who is essentially undefeated. He's a making his fifth or sixth title defense. He's on ESPN in the United States, fighting in the premier organization. He is the number one guy in the division. There's no question of any other buddy.
Yeah.
And he got paid significantly less. He even cracked $1 million. What does he get? $500K?
Something like that.
And people do like to throw in, oh, he gets pay-per-view. That's highly debatable. Highly debatable.
Yeah.
This isn't the old UFC. This is under the ESPN.
And that's debatable also because he was behind another main event title fight.
Right. He was
a co-main. Right. So
nobody really knows.
No one knows.
And nobody knows what the split is in the ESPN era, where ESPN guarantees the UFC $500,000, the equivalent of $500,000 pay-per-view buys per event.
Yeah.
I promise you they're not shelling out extra money to fighters, ESPN. They're just not. And I don't see Volkanovski cracking $500,000, or I mean Israel Adesanya even cracking $500,000 pay-per-view buys with this latest event. So this is all relevant because PFL comes out, Paul, and what are some of these numbers? Let's just say, what did Kayla Harrison earn for her fight, which was a non-championship bout?
Well, I'm going to start from the top here. So I'm just going to use, because we used Alexander Volkanovski as an example, I'm going to use someone who's a very similar size and very similar, I would say, like, notoriety to fans, and that's Anthony Pettis, who in his final fight in the UFC was paid $330,000.
And he was a big name in the UFC.
Yeah.
Former champ.
Fought.
He was on the Wheaties box.
Yeah, he fought so many times in the UFC.
Yeah, he is a very popular guy.
Yeah, absolutely. So then, now, in this fight, in the PFL, which is coming after a season where he was not very good in the first year, this is his second season. He comes out, he has a quick submission, gets himself in the playoffs. Then
let's remind people real quick that the PFL is genuinely considered by most to be about like the third best. There's UFC,
yeah.
Bellator, then PFL.
They've started to step their product up, but like,
general consensus, but they're more.
Kind of like how BKFC is. Like their talent pool is what it is because they're such a new company still. Like they have a lot of like, you know, small like high attracting like fanfare fighters.
Right.
But
he's got a fight against Stevie Ray.
So he has a fight against Stevie Ray, which he loses, unfortunately, but is still paid $750,000.
Wait, did you say $750,000 in a loss to Stevie Ray in a non-title fight in PFL?
Yeah.
Wow. So three times the amount of his last fight, and when he was champ in the UFC, he was getting $250,000 plus whatever pay-per-view points that he might have earned.
Yeah, that's a flat fee, you know?
Significantly more.
And then we go to Kayla Harrison, who gets paid $500,000
in a non-title bout. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we can go down to another guy who was fought in the UFC, Rory McDonald, who's had some rough times in his
also was in Bellator.
Career. Was in Bellator. Was a Bellator champ, well. But yeah, he was paid $250,000. So we're talking about they're paying people what they're worth. The only real criticism I could say I have here of the PFL and their pay scale is if you are well known, you are paid very well. But if you are not, you are not. I'll just use this as an example. Jeremy Stephen was paid $200,000 to fight a guy named Miles Price, who was paid $12,000.
Okay, now that sounds to keep perspective here, yeah. Let's talk about first the $500,000 that Kayla Harrison is mm-hmm. getting. That is the equivalent to what the majority of UFC champions get as
absolutely.
A flat
yeah.
fee mm-hmm. is that, and some of them earn less. Yeah. Davison Figueiredo earned less.
Mm-hmm. A lot earned less, to be honest.
Right. So she is earning the equivalent of what she would make if she went into the UFC, won a champion, and was popular. I don't know if Amanda Nunes gets a half a mil. I know that
at least probably not a flat.
Carl Harris, I mean, Usman did.
Yeah.
Okay, I know guys like John Jones did.
Yeah, that was the ultimate flop. You called Kamaru Usman. Come on.
Wasn't that shit crazy? I was hoping we could glide.
I was trying to, Jay, but I was like, what the fuck did you do? It could not be two of the most different people.
Dude, on that note, I'm a hit.
Yeah, I think you need it. That
I think y'all should check out this strain, clearly.
But no, I agree with you. A lot of these high-level UFC champions are not getting this as a flat fee.
And
you know, it's
Kayla Harrison.
Especially at Anthony Pettis' level, too. 750 flat fee? That's like what probably like Israel Adesanya is getting paid. Fucking
yeah, maybe.
John Jones. Maybe. Fucking, you know, the wasn't
Connor.
Fucking,
I think that's Connor money.
Personally. Yeah, flat fee, right?
Connor might get a milli.
A milli.
Maybe.
Plus pay-per-view, yeah. Like, that's pretty crazy.
That's amazing. And mm-hmm. look, and now let's talk about the other end, that $12,000. Dude, yeah. That's the starting money at UFC.
Yeah.
They just have Paddy Pimblett. They just paid Paddy Pimblett. 12-12 on a fucking shit, bro.
Yeah.
So I'm not too bad seeing the third level fucking
it gets
MMA promotion
12,
pay
though.
That. I'm sure it does. Bellator's got some fighters. When they put their local guys they pay them a G, bro.
They got this guy. Yeah, but you know, Bellator's kind of sneaky with what they do there. You know why they do that? Because Bellator takes guys who are amateur fighters and gives them their pro debut in Bellator.
Yeah, the local ones.
Yeah, so they pay them their price that they pay in Bellator is actually not Bellator paying them. Bellator pays the promotion that they're in a fee to let them fight, and whatever they're getting paid from that promotion is what they get paid in Bellator. That's
kind of fucked.
It's kind of not more than kind of fucked, honestly. It's
I was trying
up.
To be generous.
No, I feel you. But yeah, it's interesting here, actually. There's a couple eights in here.
I mean, I would love to hear more discussion about this.
But I'm definitely from like, if you're a guy who's at the top of the top, like, you could legitimately, if you're in a bit of a slump, you could go to the PFL and make more money than you made in your entire career.
And I'm like, pretty certain that on top of this, and it probably doesn't count for guys making the Anthony Pettis money here.
Yeah.
But I do believe for their lower guys, like this guy getting that $12,000, they have something, or at least they did when they first became the PFL, where they have some sort of monthly stipend that they pay you. So
yeah, that's what they were doing.
Right? Something every month, anyways, coming in. Yeah. It wasn't much, but it was like a couple G's. Which dude,
you're an up and comer that covers costs for whatever you know.
Small
shit.
Yeah, if you're absolutely, there's plenty of people living on $500 a week, bro. I mean,
oh yeah,
you know what I mean. Especially when you earn money when you go have a fight on top of it, you know.
Yeah, I just want to bring this up real quick. So I pulled up Anthony Pettis' last five fights and what he was paid, right? So when he fought Alex Moreno, his last fight in the UFC, which was the main event of the prelims, and his last and right before a pay-per-view.
Yeah, okay.
Or no, sorry, a fight night, Thompson Neal. He got paid $350,000, $165,000 to show, $165,000 to win.
That was with a win.
With a $20,000 fight week incentive.
So a win, the max he could make with that shit.
And then in a much higher profile fight against Donald Cerrone on UFC 249, He was paid $330,000.
Damn.
And then if you really want to see how fucked up things are, you could take a little trip down memory lane and go to when he was the UFC lightweight champion. And he fought, let's just use the Gilbert Melendez fight as an example. He was paid $100 to show and $100 to win with a $50,000 bonus to perform to the night.
Bro.
He got $250. And when he lost that title against Rafael Dos Anjos, he was paid $110,000 to be the champion of the world. Come on. What are we talking about here?
Now he's in the third ranked league. I'm not trying to talk shit about PFL. I'm just keeping it in perspective. And he's earning $750. Who knows if that's a flat fee? It probably is. Imagine if he got a win bonus on top of that. I
mean, yeah.
It's probably a flat fee.
Well, let's just say if you're Anthony Pettis, you win your two fights, and then you go into the playoffs and you win the fucking PFL championship. You're making $3 million a year. He made $3 million in his entire UFC career. 3.6 in his entire UFC career. If he effectively came in, won all three of his, or what's it, two fights in the regular season, mm-hmm. and then won all his playoff fights, wins a title, he makes as much as he made in his UFC career.
It's fucking crazy.
Plain and simple. Like, that's literally ridiculous. If he's been fighting on this contract the whole time, and he fought, what was that, twice last year when he lost in the PFL too? That's 750. So 1.5 this season, and he wins the chip. He's already, that's $4 million in two seasons that he's fought in the PFL over, I don't even want to go back and count how many times he's fought in the UFC.
Guys like Nate Diaz, no wonder they want out of their UFC contract. And he's
dude, Nate Diaz in the PFL fight. Wins a lightweight championship like this.
He does, and he probably gets a fat paycheck like that because he's a way bigger name than Anthony goddamn Pettis is.
And people he will dogged Anthony Pettis when they fought.
Yeah, people like, will tune in to see Nate Diaz. And I feel like he could light that shit up.
Yeah.
Personally. I mean, these are huge numbers. He doesn't just have to fight Jake Paul to make significantly more money. He can apparently just go to the PFL. And yeah, he doesn't have to win the championship either.
No.
That's some shit. And it should shame the UFC.
Yeah.
Because once again, we've got Dana bragging about how fucking much money they're making as a company.
Mm-hmm.
And on the flip side, though, I really want to send some praise to the PFL.
Yeah.
I mean,
for a company that seemed like it was down and out the pandemic. During the pandemic, it didn't seem like it was ever coming back.
I thought they were done. I think we talked about it on the show. But they're clearly, they have to be paying out more of a percentage than the UFC is. I don't know what their ESPN deal is worth, but they don't have a pay-per-view system in place, although they're speaking of implementing one. So this is all coming from ESPN money, ad revenue, you know, et cetera.
And that's one thing, too. PFL does a real good job of the PFL. Okay, so I'm just going to use the PFL and the UFC because this is exactly what happened to both companies, and they both handled it two different ways. So when the UFC was sold to WME, they sold a bunch of their shares off to like high-level celebrity ambassadors, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. for the UFC. Mm-hmm. And then that's similar to what the PFL has done. When the PFL was brought back and signed that ESPN deal, they also brought in a multitude of high-level, high-profile athletes, rappers, singers.
Yeah, I remember.
That all bought into the PFL, like Kevin Hart, like Wiz Khalifa, Mike Tyson. And they've then gone and turned that around and actually used those same people who are the investors and quote-unquote ambassadors of the PFL and use them for their promotion. Wiz Khalifa does the entrance, like the soft opening to every single PFL. It's Wiz Khalifa doing it. And then literally, Kevin Hart does some of the commercials for the PFL. Mike Tyson talks about the PFL on his podcast constantly. And then when you look at what the UFC did, the UFC had all these investors, but who have they used?
Nobody.
Nobody. They haven't used anybody.
In fact, they bought them all back out, to the best of my knowledge.
This doesn't make any sense.
Using any of their celebrity to promote anything.
Yeah. So, like, It's just like this mentality that the UFC is just like king, and no matter what, nothing will ever bubble up and rise up to like be as popular as them. It's just like day by day by day by day becoming less and less true, man.
True, and the PFL is pretty interesting when you watch it. I mean, they're trying new shit. Like, they give speed of punches and kicks.
And they give you an active punch count live. Like,
yeah,
you
right
know,
on
like,
the screen.
It's not like in, yeah, they show, like, where each punch is landed. Mm-hmm. They show, like, it's almost like a video game sometimes when you're watching it.
It
because,
is. They
like,
call it their smart cage.
Yeah, like, and at the bottom... Yeah, it's at the bottom of, like, it shows their name, all their measurables, and then their punch count, takedown count, all the different things that would be a part of judging the fight. So even if you're not watching or you miss something or you're just not that interested, you could genuinely watch their fights and have an idea of who's winning round by round and second by second.
And you can see the power of certain blows because they show the speed of it. So you know if somebody gets hit by a kick and it was 25 miles an hour, somebody gets hit by a kick and they show it was fucking 69 miles an hour.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, fuck, man.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool seeing that shit for fight nerds. And I think the general public, too. It just gives them more of a better understanding of what's happening in the cage, just like you said. And it's new and it's different. Mm-hmm. And
just like we've talked about the BKFC also, like, their talent pool will continue to grow the more big, high-level names that step down from these large organizations and head over there. You know what I mean? Like, getting Kayla Harrison back, although maybe to like me and you as a hardcore, want to be like, ah, it kind of sucks because I want to see her fight X, Y, and Z and all these different people, you know? Mm-hmm. But as far as like a business move, what she's doing as far as staying there, winning these PFL championships, getting paid this salary, and then getting that extra million at the end of the year, like, it's the smartest thing she could do.
Yeah.
Because like, as much as legacy matters to me and you and everyone else.
Prize fighter, though.
At the end of the day, you're exactly. It's prize fighting. You're in there to make money and get out as wealthy as you can and as healthy as you can.
Anthony Pettis made more than all the UFC champions in a base salary, losing a fight to Stevie Ray.
Yeah.
Except for maybe...
He had that one submission early in the season and lost to Stevie Ray. He's already made 1.5 this year.
In two fights, he's made more than most of them have.
He literally made $1.5 million this year already. Off of a quick submission and a freaking and a loss in a solid fight.
I was just reading Figueredo. He said he got $500,000 on his last one and 100,000 plus 100,000, so 200 on his first one. So two back to back title defenses, he got $700,000.
That's crazy. Yeah. But
anyway,
in the end, kudos to PFL.
Kudos to them. I hope it starts a trend. You know, we still don't know if this World MMA League thing is going to be an actual thing.
Yeah. Or if they'll kind of end up like the PFO.
But they sure have a different pay structure that we could be seeing soon, hopefully, as well. Because this shit has got to change. Or these fighters have got to sign shorter contracts with the UFC. Or just tell them to fuck off and go to the PFL or go to Bellator. Because Bellator offered Kayla the $500K as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why PFL matched. I mean, so they were offering it the same as UFC, too.
And that's what's funny, too, is Dana's own... I think Dana's own inability to, like, actually admit talent when he sees it is part of the problem, too. It's like he probably didn't even offer her anything like that because, in my opinion, someone like Kayla Harrison, the first fight she's in the UFC, she should be fighting for a belt. In Dana's eyes, he would go, well, she's the PFL champion, so she's going to fight the number 12 or the number 15 person in the division first. That's kind of what he's – although Michael Chandler, it's worked for him in the end – because of his own actual talent. Like, that's kind of what he did to Michael Chandler, too. It was like, Michael Chandler, oh, here you go. You're the Bellator champion. Fight the number 7 lightweight in the world. Like, or he should have just came out and fought for the belt right away. As we saw, he was literally a half of a fucking round away from being, you know, you take that beginning of the second round away, he's lightweight champion of the world. You know, like, come on.
I think it's also significant to note that the PFL matched whose offer? Bellator's offer, which means Bellator offered more than the UFC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
So now you've got both companies paying more
than
the UFC, at least.
And a lot of guys from that have made that UFC Bellator move have said that they get paid more in Bellator also. So
all the UFC defenders come out and say that's bullshit. Because, you know, you got people going to the BKFC and saying the same thing too. But I just don't believe that it's bullshit. Why would they come out and lie for their new promotion?
And what does that do for them?
All of them?
Lie? Yeah.
What? They all band together and be like, oh, let's lie to everybody. Like, get the fuck out of here.
I can understand it if it was like, oh, like Tyron Woodley, I made more fighting Jake Paul than like ever in the UFC. I can understand like someone deciding that's bullshit because that's like a circus fight. But an actual other organization who has a whole roster of fighters who has multiple champions
signing a contract
and that pays and pays $1 million to win their tournament every year and has every single year come out and done it the right way and not had a single fighter ever say that they were not getting paid what was actually fucking on paper. You know what I mean? Like, come on.
Oh, man. Let's just hope the winds of change brew because maybe it doesn't have there doesn't have to be a fighter union. Maybe there can just be some somewhat more responsible payment to fighters simply due to market competition. How do you get fighters from the UFC? Fucking pay them.
Yeah. That's true. That's the same. Well, that's why the whole structure of like MMA and like MMA promotions is different than like a boxing or like it's almost ran the same way like franchises are ran in sports. Like they're almost ran like football teams and basketball teams. Yeah. Like nobody looks at like when people talk about like MMA, no one ever looks at MMA the sport and like is like they're MMA fighters. Everyone like who is outside of the sport goes like they're a UFC fighter, they're a Bellator fighter, they're a PFL fighter. They're viewed like almost leagues, like sports franchises. Like the UFC is the fucking New York Yankees, just because you have that on. You know, right. They're one of the biggest organizations in the world, and they can pay whatever they have to pay or do whatever they have to do because they have all this extra money. And the PFL is like, I don't know, a small market team. You know, like
Triple A.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Yeah. But like where they can bring like these crazy prospects that everybody wants. But their only fear is eventually that prospect is going to be big enough that they want to go play for the Yankees. And that's the fucking the UFC.
Right.
And so, like, that's kind of the problem with MMA right now. It's not – these are not, like, franchises. You know what I mean? Like, these guys need to be – that's why there has to be a union. Because everybody has to be viewed as an individual.
Or the
Ali Act
apply, because then it would bust up the monopoly. Because then when Alexander Volkanovski is going to fight – you know, Brian Ortega again in a rematch, Bellator can bid on the rights to it. UFC can bid on it. Fucking PFL can and say, hey, we'll pay this for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, some governing body instead owns the belt, not the fucking UFC and not the PFL.
Yeah.
That works. I'm sorry. It's not perfect, but it works better than this shit.
Yeah.
But that's not going to happen either.
Yeah.
But I think that's more likely to happen than a union.
You think so?
Yeah, because how would a union apply across promotions?
Yeah, true.
I mean, it could, but it's just even more difficult.
It's more,
but the Ali Act simply opens it up. Like, there's no union in boxing. But
how do you think it would like the whole thing with Ali came from like his scenario. Like, well, someone would have to be like.
It would have to be like the
someone would
World
have to die on their
MMA
shields.
Council. The,
yeah, true.
The WMC, and then they create belts.
Yeah,
and like then. They're like, okay, this is the heavyweight title, and they would de facto maybe make the UFC heavyweight or the UFC belts their shit since they're the number or something.
Yeah.
The whole tournaments, you do something. Mm-hmm. But there has to be this governing body that creates the belts.
Yeah.
And then the UFC can bid on fights, all these guys, and then they're not under the direct control. And then that works, man. You put on the pay-per-views, I think that solves the problem too. But nobody really talks about doing that.
Yeah. That's kind of where I'm like confused. I'm not confused. Like I know what the Ali Act is. I know what it like does for like the fighters. But I'm saying like something has to happen within the MMA world that goes wrong, where a fighter feels like they have to, you know, kind of help set those.
Well,
plans
I think that's
in motion.
What this antitrust lawsuit is essentially saying.
Yeah.
Although I don't. I mean, that only applies.
But no one's using it though. That's
nobody
the problem.
Can use it. Yet.
Yeah. No one's using it.
UFC has so much money. I mean, you know how, dude, this shit's been going on longer than our podcast.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, we're at episode 140.
Yeah.
Like, well, and we don't even hear shit about it. Like, it's.
They're good at keeping it under wraps.
UFC has so much money now, you can just stall it. It sucks. Whatever. We could debate this stuff forever, but we do have some fights upcoming in the UFC that we should talk about. There's not a lot of action, folks, across the MMA sphere. Or the combat sports world in general.
Yeah. Real quick, though, I do want to bring something up about this card and about these cards in general. I've now realized what the pattern is. It's lower level fighters on the Apex Fight Night cards, and then when we put a crowd in front of people, we put together actual good card full of ranked fighters and names we know for Fight Nights. Because that's what this is compared to last weekend. Last weekend, it was like a lot of like up and coming guys. Like, yeah, there were some good ones here and there and everywhere, but generally everyone's eyes were on the main event. This card is solid top to bottom. We've got fighters from all over the divisions, a lot of ranked guys, a lot of people who are actually that watch the UFC would know. You know,
and this is taking place somewhere else, isn't it?
It's in New York.
It's in New York, so there's a crowd.
The crowd.
So it's headlined by Ortega versus Rodriguez, which we talked about. We've got a handful of other fights on there that are solid here, just on the main card. We've also got that Misha Tate, Lauren Murphy fight, which is pretty significant.
Yeah, which was moved over from, what was it, last weekend or the weekend before to this one?
We've got a good strawweight matchup as the co-main. We've got Amanda Lemos versus Michelle Waterson. Haven't seen Michelle in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Got Li Jinglang coming back at welterweight. You know, Matt Schnell coming back at flyweight. He's been a solid prospect. I think he's finally ranked now, perhaps. Mm-hmm.
And then, honestly, what I feel like is like probably going to be the fight of the night. It's Shane Burgos versus Charles Jourdain.
Well, let's talk about that fight. I mean, Shane Burgos is 14-3 right now. Jourdain's 13-4-1.
Mm-hmm.
These are Shane's always a solid action fighter. What are your thoughts? Like, what do you? Why do you think this will be fight of the night?
That's just what I've seen from Shane Burgos every time he steps out there. You know, he is a fight of the night waiting to happen. Like, literally, the guy's got a hell of a chin. He's been in there with some of the better guys in the division, and you know, he's just never out of it. You know what I mean? He's lost to a lot of the bigger guys, but he still fought everybody. You know,
he's an action fighter.
Yeah, and he's just constant go, 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 and yeah, I think this is going to be a really good fight.
I like it. It's a good one to open up the card with.
Mm-hmm.
I got a solid question, though. I don't know where this fight lands on the card itself. I can't imagine it's as low as it's showing on this list that we're looking at, which is like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the sixth fight down from the main event. Maybe it is.
Open the card.
Look, we finally got this rescheduled bout where Misha Tate is making her debut at flyweight against Lauren Murphy, who is the number 3 ranked flyweight. You know, she's 15-5. She's tough. She is coming off a loss to the champion. She earned a title shot. She did all right in that fight.
Yeah.
I mean, she's good.
She fought the number 1 pound woman in the world.
And Misha Tate, you know, she's not small. She's not one of these women that were up at 35 that should have been a flyweight but couldn't because they didn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that was essentially what the division was.
Yeah.
This is it. The UFC only had 35, so you had a lot of women that should have been a little lower.
Yeah.
And they got 25, and then they got some, a lot of them dropped down from 35. Very similar to 25 suffered from that a little bit until they had, you know, strawweight, or however the situation played out. I can't remember exactly, but my point being, a lot of them were 35 dropped down. Misha Tate is, my point being, a solid 135-pounder.
Mm-hmm.
I think this weight cut's too much for her. I don't think she's going to do as good as she thinks she is, and I think Lauren Murphy stands a strong chance of beating her.
I think it's a very interesting matchup, to be honest. Misha Tate is, she's in a weird spot as far as her career, because you see her come back to the game. She won, what, 2 at 135 and lost 1 before moving down now?
Or was it 1-1? She lost to, what was it, Durandamine?
No, she lost to Kaitlyn Vieira.
Oh, yeah.
But she, so she kind of ran into someone who was a legit 35, and I think Vieira's big enough to fight 45 still.
Probably.
But my point being is, I think coming into this part of her career, like dropping down might be the answer. Just because I think the division, although I agree with everything you said, like she's a solid 135 as far as like her size. Like, she would not be that physically imposed by other fighters at that weight class. But this is a different division since she stepped away. You know what I mean? Since she retired, since she's gone away from the UFC, I think the 135 class kind of passed her up. And I think if she wants to stay in the title hunt and wants to be able to maybe have a chance at like what this whole, you know, comeback has supposed to be, which was like a revival of her career and like a chance to maybe capture that gold again.
Well, that's what
it would
she
have
says.
To be at 125.
Well, yeah, she got knocked out of the equation at 35.
Unless she went into
45. She's also 35 years old.
Yeah.
So now she's, you know, traditionally, as you get older as a fighter, we tend to see them move up in weight because the weight cuts become more difficult the older you become. Now, I understand that situation is a little bit difficult for her because there's not really a 145 division for her to move up to, and she would still wind up fighting Amanda.
Yeah.
But that there was no talk of that. She is 5'6", so she's not exceptionally tall, maybe, for flyweight. But let's just give her the victory here. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's say she beats Lauren Murphy. She's already calling out Shevchenko. It makes sense, I think, for her to get the title shot.
It has to be.
Lauren Murphy's third ranked, and the two people above her are what? Chikugian and the girl that Amanda or Valentina just fought.
I got you. I have pulled up.
So,
script.
Caitlin Vieira.
Yeah. Or not Vieira, I'm sorry. That's who we were just talking about.
Oh, yeah, that's who just beat Tate.
Yeah. Talia Santos.
Yeah, Santos. Okay. So they're not getting any title shots, so it makes sense. But okay, so let's just give it to her. Does Misha Tate stand a fucking chance against Valentina Shevchenko firing on all four cylinders?
It would have to be like the most like successful wrestling, like straight up wrestling fucking game plan we would ever see executed in the octagon. Like legitimately, it would have to be that. There's no other path of victory I see for Misha outside of just taking Valentina down. And I don't even know if she could do anything with the ground and pound, but you know what I mean? Just like keeping her there for 5 rounds, that would have to be like the only scenario in which I would see her beating Valentina.
Right. I mean, since being the Strikeforce champion, right, in 2011, I mean, she comes in, she loses to Ronda, right? She gets a win over Julie Kedzie. Then she loses a TKO to Kat Zingano. She loses again to Ronda Rousey. Then she goes on a pretty significant win streak. She beats Liz Carmouche. She beats Rin Nakai. I'm not sure. Sarah McMahon, Jessica Eye, gets the win over Holly Holm, right? Gets her back to Amanda Nunes, where she loses in a rear naked choke. Then she loses to Raquel Pennington after that. Then she does get this win over Marlon Renault in her comeback. You know, that was 2016 where she lost to Raquel Pennington. Takes all this time off.
When was she the champion when she beat Holly? When was that?
She beat Holly in 2016, March 5th.
So if she were to somehow beat Shevchenko, that would be 6 years, 7 years later by the time she gets her, would have a chance to get the title back.
But I mean, against top competition, she's lost. She lost to Amanda Nunes. Then she loses to Raquel Pennington. She gets this TKO victory over Renault. But then she loses to Caitlin Vieira, a decision. And now she's like, what, you think you're going to beat Shevchenko off that? I mean, what have we seen in these fights that would give us any indication she stands a prayer of beating Valentina Shevchenko?
It would have to be an off night. But like I said, it would have to be just like a perfect game plan and an off night for Valentina. Like, it would have to be that. There's no other scenario in which I see her beating Valentina or even having a chance to.
Well, this is it. This is her shot. She wins this fight. I think she's guaranteed the title shot because Shevchenko can't do what she wanted to do, which is fight Nunes a third time. She can't even go fight Pena until this other matter is settled. So there's time in there for another title defense. Mm-hmm. This is it. Misha Tate gets a big victory here. She's going to call out Shevchenko.
Yeah.
This is her moment. This is her fucking shot. Sadly, though, I don't even know if she wins this fight, but if she does, I don't think she stands a chance.
Yeah.
Like, Shevchenko would have to make massive mistakes.
Which
she just made a few in her last fight. I don't think she's going to repeat it in her next fight. She's just not that type of fighter.
She made, like, ultimate mistakes in her last fight and still won.
Yeah.
She let a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt hang on her back with a body triangle for a whole, damn near a whole 4 minutes, fighting off of rear naked choke that looked like it was sunk in about three different times.
Right. off, like, what was it, like a failed takedown where she, yeah. like...
Where did, she got, she just hopped to her back and right fell away.
On her back. Yeah. And, yeah.
So it's like, if that... If she was able to get out of that, I just don't. I don't see a scenario where she just makes enough mistakes to where Misha beats her. Like it just doesn't seem.
But look, it does make this fight interesting, though.
It does, yeah. And that's what the thing is. Is it's not necessarily about her having being the most deserving as far as like who would get the next shot with Valentina. She's got the biggest name, and she'd have a win against somebody in the top three. And I think those are the two driving forces behind her being able to get a shot at
and
Valentina.
And one and two above her already have losses recent.
Recent, yeah. The only other sense it would make would be like if you ran it back with Talia Santos.
So
it's
three,
but it's
for
like,
that matter, because Lauren Murphy's
you can hold on to that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, too, is like this whole division's kind of like that. Is it's filled with contenders that maybe you could like give another reason why you'd give them another shot at Valentina. But I'd almost like to see Talia Santos like, earn it again because I do think she's good enough to continue to get better. Like she's at a point where she had the champion on the ropes and she probably has the best performance against Valentina since Amanda Nunes.
She had a great performance combined with some
mistakes
from the champ, mm-hmm. which don't discredit anything Santos did, but it still mm-hmm. wasn't enough. I don't agree with Juliana Pena's comments that Valentina was exposed. It makes it sound like she's not good, but she wasn't exposed.
Yeah, she wasn't exposed. She just made mistakes. Yeah.
She made some mistakes and still pulled out enough to win. I kind of equate it to the first John Jones versus Alexander Gustafsson fight, where everybody was like, oh, it was John Jones isn't as good as John Jones had a bad night.
Yeah.
Still found it in his heart to win.
And that's the same thing.
And then proved it later in a rematch. Like, yeah,
I feel like that comparison is really good too, because I do think Talia Santos is going to be like the 1B of this division for a while. I think she's good enough to beat everybody else, just like Gustafsson. Gustafsson was pretty much good enough to beat everybody else at light heavyweight except John Jones. Mm-hmm. And like the small things are why Valentina is better and always is going to be better. And I think that those small things and like her, that championship mentality is always going to carry over a lot of these women in this division, I think.
Right, and Shevchenko shows no signs of slowing down, where I think is if you look at, like, Nunes, you could see signs of her life changing, her priorities changing a little bit. She got married, she had a baby, she took time off, she's got a girlfriend, it's all in the news, and in the UFC, and it's a big, they're a family. Shevchenko's out there shooting fucking shit and fighting.
Yeah.
You know, she's, like, in the John Jones fucking mode of focus, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, you can make arguments he had his children and all this other stuff, too, but not... You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't think we've seen the peak. So I think if somebody even manages to beat Shevchenko
everybody
on an off night, she'll win the rematch.
That's what MMA is at the end of the day. It's like, that's why people don't care about everyone's records. MMA is a game of runs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you make your big run and your long, whether it's 5 fights, 4 fights, or 15 fights, that's your peak, and that's where at least me as a fan, that's where I rate you as far as how good or how great or how much of a legend you are.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where Valentina is and where Amanda is kind of gearing out of. You know what I mean? Like, we saw the great performances against her, like, with her and, like, Holly Holm and all those other great performances, where it is now is when people start to catch up. Like, that's just the natural progression of every sport, you know?
Well, let's talk about... I mean, do you want to discuss this Michelle Waterson fight at all?
Yeah, I'm down.
I mean, it looks interesting. I mean, Michelle's Amanda always fun to watch, but, you know, she's another one that's, I don't know how much longer she's got to keep hanging around in the top 10 here before she makes something of it.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't see her getting title shots anytime soon. She's going to have her hands full, I think, with Amanda.
Amanda Lemos is good. She's really good. And Waterson is kind of, like you said, I think she is on the back end of her career for sure.
Yeah. I feel she's getting kind of a gatekeeper role here.
Possibly. I'm taking Lemos.
Yeah, me too. I think that's a given. I mean, I like the karate hottie. Mm-hmm. She's been a fun addition to the UFC. I wish, you know, she would have got there sooner. And she's fighting above the weight class she should be in, too. She's really a 108-pound fighter.
Yeah.
And she's fighting up at 115 because that's what they got. You know, she's in a spot that a lot of women, and we were in, as we were discussing earlier, you know, and no shade there. I believe she was the Invicta 108-pound champ, was she not?
Something like that.
Yeah. Like, she hit the pinnacle that she could for that weight class. Mm-hmm. And then was willing to step up to a bigger class and fight bigger women, some even dropping down from 125, which I don't think she could stand a prayer of ever making.
Yeah.
You know, so it should be an interesting fight, though. We'll see. You know, maybe she's got another run in her, like you were just saying. It is all about runs.
It's a game of runs.
And, I mean, look, age doesn't always
look at all the
anything.
Champions right now.
Look at Glover Teixeira.
Glover Teixeira.
He had a nice run.
Yep.
You know, got into the championship at 40 fucking two.
Exactly.
So it could happen.
Exactly. But, even Usman. Usman's old. Usman's like 34.
Yeah.
It's a game of runs. Let's talk about the main event now, though. This is a real. This fight has a lot of big consequences for the division.
Yeah, there's a lot of implications here.
Yeah, we got two guys in Brian Ortega and Yair Rodriguez who are at the tip top of the division. Where you're looking at Brian Ortega is coming off of the loss to Volkanovski, and Yair Rodriguez is coming off his loss to Max Holloway. So this is do or die time for both of them.
Right. For Rodriguez, it was only his third loss of his career. Ortega, only the second loss of his career. Both fucking...
Both of the champions.
Yeah, both of the champions. Both could get right back into title contention with victories here. Very interesting fight. Yair Rodriguez has got a lot of flash. He's got a lot of unusual strikes. You know, he's got that KO over the Korean Zombie, which is, you know, just one of the more unusual elbows you're going to see.
Ever, yeah.
Ortega, his striking has gotten better.
Much
we all
better.
Know his jiu-jitsu game is on point.
If you look at Ortega's last fight against Volkanovski, he was the closest one to beating Volkanovski in the division.
Ortega
had
looked way better.
He literally had Volkanovski done. Everyone on planet Earth gets choked out by that choke. I do not know how Volkanovski survived that, to be honest. Like,
because he's a tough, tough son of a bitch, apparently.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, he had him. Ortega looked better in that fight than, like you said, any of other Volkanovski's other opponents. And I'm certain that he has been working extremely hard since then to improve his game as well.
And just to use a common opponent, Brian Ortega, we kind of saw the evolution of his game when he fought the Korean Zombie out in Abu Dhabi. And since then, he's just been a complete different fighter. His striking has gotten so much better. You know, his jiu-jitsu is always top-notch. But just his ability to stand on the feet and in the pocket and throw. He's another one, though, that, like, he doesn't get as much credit for it, but Brian Ortega does throw a lot of, like, obscure strikes. He throws a lot of weird elbows and
very strange angles.
Yeah, and also his explosion is like, a big part of his game as well.
Without a doubt. I like him to win this fight here. I don't think it's enough to get him back to a title shot yet. I think
he'll
need one more, but a solid victory here, perhaps even a KO or a submission, would go a long way towards making the case, especially if he looks as improved as I expect him to be.
Yeah.
I think he's been working hard on his striking. I think we're going to see a noticeable improvement there. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him get a TKO victory here. Or possibly, you know, use his hands to knock him to the ground and then go in for the sub.
Yeah. I do have to give a little bit of credit here to Yair Rodriguez real quick, just because his last fight against Max Holloway, I do think he looked extremely improved overall in, like, his actual, like, ability and his toughness in there. Because, I mean, I feel like that's always been a question for, like, a lot of people have always, like, you know, wondered what his toughness level was. And
yeah,
I think,
like, when somebody turns it up on him, can he hang in there?
Mm-hmm. And I really feel like, I really feel like he proved that in the Max fight. And I don't know. It's tough for me to pick against Brian here because I do think he has the ultimate X factor in his jiu-jitsu. Because I don't think Brian's on the same level as Yair as far as his striking. But I think his striking is more comparable to Yair's striking than Yair's jiu-jitsu is to Brian's jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, absolutely. I still think there's a chance here that Ortega could wind up as champion when Volkanovski eventually leaves the division. He's going to be a little bit more wide open. I think Ortega could be the guy if he continues to make the improvements that we've seen in the past.
Volk said he's not leaving the division. He said he's going to defend both belts.
Now, I know he says these things, and he might be able to do it. There's no denying that he's made 3 title defenses in 9 months.
Have we seen a male double champ defend both belts yet?
We have not. Well, there's some try to say that, like, Cormier did, but I feel like there's an asterisk there somewhere that I don't know what it is.
Did he defend the lightweight title after he was heavyweight? I thought he never went back down to light heavyweight after heavyweight. Down.
So, yeah, I'm pretty sure Volk might be able to do it. We'll see. He could definitely... Let's just see if he can get the titles first. But
yeah,
in the event that he actually leaves the division, I see Ortega being the most likely future champion.
So like we talked about in the intro, let's kind of go into this now. So do you think a win by either of these two gets them to leapfrog Josh Emmett to fight Volkanovski next?
I hope not, because I feel that Josh Emmett deserves it. But seeing the way that Emmett was snubbed at the fights a couple weeks ago, where they didn't even give him a good seat, they didn't give him any camera time, there was no mention of him fighting for the title, he was stuck up in the goddamn rafters.
Yeah,
like, he was pissed about it. His manager talked about it. He talked about it. Fucking Faber fucking talking about it. Like, what in the fuck?
Yeah.
The UFC gives every indication that they don't give a fuck about Josh Emmett at the moment for some strange reason. He's an exciting fighter. He's got KO power.
He's fought top-level competition, too.
Is he boring?
Yeah, he's never been boring. He's, won 5 or 6 in a row. He just beat Calvin Kattar, who is ranked 4th in the division.
Who's an exciting action fighter.
Yeah,
it was a great
fight.
What are
we talking about here?
Like, for some reason, though, I could see the UFC, if one of these two guys puts on a spectacular performance or even just gets a KO or a sub, I could see the UFC promoting one of them above it because they feel it has more name value for some reason.
Yeah.
Do I think it's deserving? No. I think Ortega needs another fight, and so would Rodriguez for that matter.
Well, here's the thing. Here's a little turn in the questioning here, because I forgot about this going into this episode, but... it was reported over the weekend that Volkanovski had to get surgery on his hand, and he could be out for an extended period of time. So if that does happen, although I don't think either of them should leapfrog Josh Emmett for the title shot, I think Josh Emmett should fight the winner of this before either of them fight for the belt.
Yeah.
Because although I do feel Josh is deserving, but if we're going to have a Volkanovski who's going to be out for an extended period of time, being a contender and sitting out is never a good idea, because the problem is recency bias. There's always going to be recency bias when we talk about fighting in the UFC. There's always guys who are deserving of title shots who then sit out, like Leon Edwards is a perfect example. Leon Edwards has been honestly pretty deserving of a title shot for his last 4 fights.
This is true.
But what happened was he had visa issues, he had injuries, he had reasons he couldn't fight for the title, and he has now been on like a 3 or 4 year endless pursuit. I know he's fighting for the title now, but he's been on a pretty much three and a half year pursuit of the championship, although he's been deserving of his title shot ever since he whooped RDA's ass 4 years ago.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I'm just worried for Josh Emmett's sake that could happen to him, because he is in a division full of killers. And all it takes is one of those guys to put on a scenario like George Masvidal KOing Askren, and then they get the title shot.
It's unfortunate, but it could happen. With Volkanovski, there is a possibility that he's bought himself some goodwill with Dana White, though, because he has defended his title 3 times in a 9-month period. And he is on an incredibly long winning streak. He took the 3rd fight with Max Holloway when he probably could have fought the UFC against it for a while.
Yeah.
And Dana came out publicly after him saying he wanted to fight for the lightweight title and said, hey, this guy's earned the right to do whatever he wants to do.
Yeah.
So he could realistically go ahead and give him 6 months off without even booking a fight, check up on him later, then talk about a next fight, then give his hand time to heal, and then let him go fight for the lightweight title next and keep people on ice.
Yeah.
Without even creating an interim
title. And that's why I think Josh has to fight the winner of this.
And I think Dana would do that because it gives him an extra interim title he can create in the meantime if they need it. It's like one on the back burner.
Yeah, I don't want that, though.
I don't want that, but they love doing that shit in the UFC. Yeah. They love themselves to have an interim title.
Yeah.
And they could just let the champ heal up, give him 6 months off without any question of a next fight, check up on him then say,
I don't know you've if earned a
lightweight
like
title, because by then we'll know what's up with Oliveira. Mm-hmm. Say, hey, you've earned the fucking shit at lightweight. Go ahead and announce that fight. Not announce the interim featherweight bout unless they need it. Some pay-per-view title falls through, they'll be like, oh, interim title for the featherweight.
Yeah, true. That could happen. That very well can happen. And I just had a weird-ass thought in my head I don't even want to talk about because we'll go on a total tangent.
Well, I'm sure our listeners love that.
Oh, yeah. Nah, okay. So I was thinking, you know, like if Charles Oliveira has been like begging to fight Conor McGregor for the vacant title.
That's true. He has.
Conor beat Charles Oliveira. And then fought Volkanovski. That would be a dream scenario.
That'd be
because
nuts.
That's if you really look at it, like outside of Max and Jose, like that's the only other like featherweight goat that Conor hasn't fought.
That's actually a thing that could happen.
That's what I'm saying. And no, because I'm talking about it because of something Volk has said recently before his fight with Max, that he said that he would fight Conor at 55. That he's not going to call him out and not like force him like he doesn't see the need to call him out, but he said he would take that fight in a heartbeat if given the chance at 155 he would fight him.
Conor could possibly beat Oliveira because of Oliveira's tendency to stand in the first round. I mean, yeah. He's been almost finished by the last three guys he's fought. Now he's won those fights, mm-hmm. But Conor's a little bit different, or so we think.
If he fights,
and this is bulked up Conor too, he could be even more powerful. So there's a possibility he could KO Charles Oliveira in the first round, become the lightweight champion,
and fight Volkanovski.
That is a thing that could happen.
And knowing Conor, he'd be like, "Make it for both belts."
He would. He would call himself a 5-belt champion or some shit. Yeah.
He would do it. He'd be like, "I'm the only one who get double belts twice."
Yeah. The champ, 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 champ.
Champ, 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 champ.
That'd be interesting. I wouldn't even be against that. I mean, look, the UFC loves to book Conor in title fights. There's no doubt to me he could walk into his next fight being a title shot. In fact, honestly, Paul, I would be more surprised if he's not in a title fight in his comeback fight than if he is.
Yeah, 100%.
It just depends on what weight.
People, I'm not saying it's just.
No.
Not at all.
Nobody's saying he deserves it.
But will it happen? Most likely.
You know who the UFC thinks deserves it?
Who's that?
Themselves. Yeah. Yeah, they deserve to have Conor in a title fight because they reap all the money.
Absolutely, yeah.
They just got to give Conor his little hunk and then they get
everything else.
Fat shit.
Yeah.
I mean, fuck, Conor's been gone so long, people just forgot. Casuals would be like, oh, yeah, Conor.
He's fighting for the belt, right?
Fighting for the title. Oh, shit.
The fucking diehards will rip all their hairs out, though, and be so upset.
Of course. The Conor haters would have a meltdown.
They will have a meltdown.
I wouldn't even hate it, though. As undeserving as it would be, as much as I talk about it.
It's so sport. Undeserving, but I'd watch. Fucking watch anytime Conor steps in.
Yeah, it's true.
There's all kinds of rumors about what he's doing next, though. I saw a rumor that Floyd offered him $160 million to fight him again.
Yeah, Floyd needs that big hurrah after, like, he still ain't paid fucking Logan Paul his money.
Yeah.
That's how bad
never
that
will,
last
bro. Was. That's what people don't understand. People like to be like, oh, he's going to pay him. It's blah, blah, blah. I don't know why he's bitching. He's not going to pay him. You know why he's not going to pay him? Because exactly the same way that Dana White broke down why people don't get paid the numbers with Jake Paul is the same reason why they don't get paid with how they fight Floyd in these exhibitions. Or exhibitions, whenever you have an exhibition, it's not overseen by a commission. So if you have an exhibition that's not overseen by a commission, there's loopholes in all those contracts you sign because it's not overseen by anybody but the two who are involved in the contract.
And who do you think has smarter lawyers? Exactly. Paul brothers or the Mayweather?
Mayweather, yeah, come on. Bro.
But you can say what you want about Mayweather as a human. His business acumen
is top notch.
He's clearly top notch, mm-hmm. And he's got
he knows what the fuck he's doing.
Logan The Pauls may be rich, but they ain't Mayweather rich.
No. Not even close. But yeah, there's that rumor swirling around that he's offering Conor 160 mil to rematch him.
That's so much money. Conor is all up on that, I promise.
Dude, he would do it. He would 100% do it. He would do it in a heartbeat.
And the UFC can't stop him either, let's be honest. If that's what Conor decided he wanted to do, the UFC cannot stop him. They cannot stop him in court. They already did the fucking first one. Yeah. How are you going to... What are your legal grounds to stop him this time?
Yeah. Hey, and now he's protected by the Aliyev because he has a professional boxing record.
Yeah, exactly. Before it's a whole different thing if he wanted to, like...
If he really wanted to go to court on it.
The UFC will try to... They'll just partner with him.
Because he'll give the UFC a chunk if they want to come in on it.
Well, they'll partner. They'll get their chunk. They won't fight it. Yeah. To fight it would be to lose.
They'll fight
to partner with him means to win.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And win is also probably what Conor won't do in that fight.
But no, probably not. Most likely not. But I don't know.
Logan Paul gave him some trouble, but Logan's a big boy.
He didn't give me any trouble. He was fucking around the whole time. That's my thing. I wouldn't
not
be
real trouble.
Yeah,
I'm exaggerating.
I don't know. It'd be more dangerous than fighting Logan Paul. I'll just say that. Like that's for sure. Like if they fought again, like it's a lot. But that's the thing. I just don't even see them fighting again. Because what you think? Conor's gonna make 147 again? Looking like how he is right now. Because that's what he made the first time they fought 147.
Conor looks like he's gearing for 170.
Yeah. Or just like a sick ass cut to 55.
Well, yeah. Ooh.
Yeah.
That would be a cut like his 45 cuts were, where he looked like a different person on the fucking scale. You're like, Jesus Christ, is he going to die?
He's looking a lot more Michael Chandler than he is fucking Max Holloway lately.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? He is looking pretty yak.
Dude, okay, well, you want to talk about people bulking up like Conor's bulking up. What about this news about Stipe Miocic being fucking 250?
250, I know. That's
crazy. Coming from a solid source. That's coming from Chris Weidman. I don't think Weidman
trains with him.
Any reason to go out and bullshit about Stipe's size, which is going to be verifiable pretty fucking soon anyway.
Well, here's the thing. Stipe was only, 235 when he fought Daniel or something like that? So
he got down as low as in the 220s before. Yeah. And this is going to be all muscle. So he's putting on 20 pounds of muscle.
I feel like he's going to look what he looked like again when he fought, what's his name? When he won the chip.
He's going to be fucking Uber Stipe.
Who is it he won the title off of?
Dude, what if he comes out and he looks like fucking Ngannou? Like, maybe not exactly, but what if he's like fucking like bodybuilder?
We've seen him like that though in his career. Like, there's been times in his career that he's been a lot bigger than what he is right now.
I think he got up as high as 247 for one bout, but I could be wrong.
Yeah,
but he hasn't been no 250. He's always part of his whole thing.
He's lighter, faster.
Yeah, lighter, faster, because he was a baseball player.
Yeah.
And when he first came in, they talked about how he was a new breed that was going to beat Kane because of that size that he had being fucking this fucking weight in there.
Yeah.
He was light in that last fight against Cormier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure it was 227. I'm pulling it up right now.
Well, the last fight was in Ghana.
Yeah, but I was just thinking
That's really the...
That was when he was showing up lighter, though, right?
Well, yeah, that should be interesting. John Jones is looking like he's right there with him, though. As far as, like, size, Jones is looking humongous. Did you see him the other night when he was quartering his teammate in the PFL? Yeah. He looked fucking huge.
Yeah, he is fucking very large. Yeah, I'm trying to get weights. It's not as easy to grab as you would think.
Yeah.
On the fly here.
It's all good. I know what you're saying, though.
But him being 250 plus and thick
is a different,
very interesting. Yeah.
That's kind of what we were talking about earlier. It's a point in his career where he's got to make a change. He knows he has to make a change. He sees the... Because that's kind of what the whole top of the division of the heavyweights are right now. You got guys like Ciryl Gane, guys like Ngannou, Tom Aspinall. They're all big, wide-rangy, just like Stipe was. But now they've gotten taller and wider and stronger, and you gotta catch up.
Yeah. I mean, Stipe is 6'4". He's got room to fucking pack on. Absolutely. Some muscle for sure.
Yeah. But that's kind of the division standard now, and if you got to be above it, or you got to find a way to beat it.
We'll see what happens, man. Good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think that about wraps up our show for today.
I think so. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. So glad you joined us. Hope you enjoyed yourself smoking something decent along with us. And if you're brand new to the show, you can catch us wherever podcasts are distributed, from Spotify to Amazon to Google and Apple, including video up on YouTube. We've got a brand new place you can find all that information at. Where is it, Paul?
SWATMA.com, or you can head over there, click the gear button, and help support the podcast. And then head over to Instagram and follow us at SWAT MMA Podcast. And happy 710, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Peace.